You are listening to Migrant Matters Radio on CFRU 93.3 FM.
For over 120 years, May 1st has been designated International Workers' Day. In Canada, the working class is currently being forced deeper into poverty through the policies of our governments, which are controlled by corporate interests. It is through unity and solidarity that we can win. We also remember that many of the most exploited workers in Canada today are strategically being denied status and thus not being provided with the same basic rights as other workers. This has created a two-tiered, apartheid-like system where big business can drive down all of our living standards. We stand with our sisters and brothers to demand status for all and good jobs, food, healthcare, education, shelter, housing, justice, and dignity for all people, irrespective of immigration status. Jason Kenney and the Harper Conservatives have stepped up their attack in the last year with U.S.-style immigration raids and deportations and racist refugee and temporary foreign worker program reforms. Now more than ever, we must fight back.
We're presenting today a recording of the 2010 May Day dinner and panel discussion held in Guelph, Ontario.
The panel is titled Speaking from the Forefront of the Struggle for Immigrant Justice and Workers' Rights. This panel was organized by the local migrant worker justice group Fuerza Puerza, meaning strength in Spanish and Tagalog. Tagalog is a dialect spoken in the Philippines, one of the main ones. Fuerza Puerza is an all-volunteer grassroots group of community members in Guelph dedicated to exposing the injustices faced by migrant workers, non-status people, and racialized working class immigrants. Above all and central to Fuerza Puerza's work is to be an effective ally to migrant racialized working class people themselves, prioritizing their dignity and agency. This panel features speakers representing the independent, humanitarian, solidarity-based organizations No One Is Illegal Toronto, Canadian Humanitarian Appeal for the Relief of Tamils, more popularly known as Canadian HEART, acronym HEART, Migrante Ontario, and the Communist Party of Canada. Each share the experiences of their communities as being comprised of racialized, working class, and poor immigrants and migrants in Canada, illustrating the hardships, inequalities, racism, and other abuses inherent in the process of forced migration to Canada. They also examine the recent changes in the Canadian immigration system and focus on the work that grassroots, anti-oppressive community organizations have and are doing in Southern Ontario
to create change.
The
Toronto chapter of No One Is Illegal is a group of immigrants, refugees, and allies fighting for the rights of all migrants to live with dignity and respect. They believe that Canada's immigration policies are racist and the border policies are designed to exploit and marginalize migrants. Mohan Mishra joined us from Toronto to discuss No One Is Illegal's recent work dealing with the Harper Conservatives' increasingly destructive immigration policies. It is this talk which we present to you now on Migrant Matters Radio, CFRU 93.3 FM.
Again, my name is Mohan Mishra. I'm an organizer with No One Is Illegal Toronto. No One Is Illegal Toronto is a community-based anti-colonial migrant justice group based in Toronto. We're also part of a No One Is Illegal network, which has groups in across the country, in Vancouver, in Ottawa, in Montreal, in Halifax. I think just to step back a bit, to understand the work that we do and how we approach it, I think it's important to first understand the myth of Canada and kind of some of the underlying myths of Canada as a nation. So a lot of people, they hear Canada, they think peacekeeper, multicultural, you know, mosaic, it's all great and, you know, rainbows and bunnies here. I think to understand, like, looking at that Canada's actual legacy and the reality of Canada, it's completely different. The Canadian state supports, has, and continues to support wars and occupations abroad, from business interests and corporations supporting the war in Afghanistan the war in Iraq, to Canadian troops in Afghanistan, to Canada's unparalleled support of Israeli apartheid, to, you know, support of the coup in Haiti, and continue and still sending police and troops down there to fortify that coup. I think we need to also look at economic policies. For example, NAFTA, when Canada signed NAFTA, it instantly, a million subsistence farmers instantly lost their livelihoods and displaced something like 20 million people. Also, I think we need to look at Canadian business interests, like, for example, mining companies. In the state in India where my family's from, it's called Orissa, there's actually a huge battle over there where a Canadian mining company called Alcan went in and basically tried to open up a giant mine on top of indigenous villages of people that had lived there for generations. They went in, polluted the water, basically cut off mountaintops in an effort to mine bauxite and aluminum that just destroyed the livelihoods, the entire way of life of the people that have lived there. And when these folks tried to fight back against this company, the company was supported by the state government, and they were basically displaced from this land that, you know, they'd lived on for generations. And I mean, there's many, many examples like that. Toronto's the biggest mining town in the world. There's examples you can look at, like Barrick Gold support for the dictatorship in Chile, or mining interest from, you know, the Philippines to Latin America, all over the place. Canada really plays a huge role in displacing people the world over. So when we talk, and no one's legal, about challenging immigration policies, we're not talking about it from the point of appealing to the Canadian government to do the right thing because they're so nice and benevolent. What we're really doing is demanding justice from them, recognizing the fundamental responsibility that the Canadian government has to the people that it displaces the world over. I think also when we're talking about this work, and something that's also foundational to the work we do, is the recognition that you can't have justice for migrants on stolen land without directly challenging the oppression of indigenous people on this land. I don't know if a lot of people here know, but maybe some do, that when you think of the word apartheid, what do you think of? Usually South Africa decades ago. But the South African government actually came to Canada to study the system of reserves here in Canada so that they could base their system of apartheid in South Africa on that. So, I mean, Canada has a long history of injustice and oppression of indigenous peoples and migrants here. And what we work to do is actually build solidarity between indigenous people and migrants, because out of that recognition. So that means whenever we're doing workshops or talks or organizing in different communities around Toronto, that we're always talking about this stuff and trying to work with people to build solidarity between migrant communities and indigenous people, which has involved, you know, support for Six Nations and Grassy Narrows and Tiendanega, and actually going into those communities and talking about the similar and shared struggles between indigenous communities and migrant communities here. So I think with that as a bit of context to the work we do, I've also been asked to talk about some of the recent changes to the immigration system by the Conservative government. And, you know, I'm going to try to kind of shorten it down, because there's really been a lot. They've been busy lately. One of the big ones that we've recently seen coming down from the Conservative Immigration Ministry is the changes to the Temporary Foreign Workers Program. Have you folks heard about this program before, Temporary Foreign Workers Program?
Yeah.
So basically what it is a system where Canada brings in people on temporary work permits, about 250,000 per year. It's a huge number of people, where basically their status is tied to their work. And there's different kinds of sectors of this program. There's a seasonal agricultural workers program where people have been brought in mostly from the Caribbean and from Mexico. Some people have been coming on this program for 20 years. They come here, work for 6-8 months, and they get sent back. And 20 years later, they're still in the same grind, still don't have any kind of permanent status here. The thing about this is that their status is tied to their employer. So if they get sick, if they get treated really badly at work, if they complain and get fired, then they get kicked out of the country. So really, immigration is acting as an enforcer for bad bosses to impose these conditions on these temporary workers. You also have, and I'm sure Mara's going to talk about this as well, first live-in caregiver program, where again, mostly, you know, where women are brought in from countries around the world to basically be caregivers here for Canadian families. And again, their status is tied to their work. So if you're being treated badly by your boss, where you have to live in the house with them as well, or being abused or anything like that, you are really at a danger if you speak up, because, of course, you could lose your status and again be deported, and that's always a threat. That's always a threat that immigration enforces to keep people vulnerable, to keep people as cheap labor, to keep people working in shitty conditions, afraid to speak up. Beyond those two programs, which are actually make up a smaller part of the temporary foreign worker program, there's a huge number of people who are here working in Tim Hortons or working in a restaurant or working wherever, again, with the same conditions. Recently, what the Conservative government has done is introduced a proposal where people on the temporary foreign workers program would come in and work for 4 years and then be banned for 6 years. So it's essentially a standing deportation order. You come in here, work your ass off, usually under really bad conditions, and then after 4 years, they kick you out. You're then banned from coming back to the country for 6 years on any visa, on anything. So what does that do? It keeps people, again, from being able to build community, being able to build those relationships and support systems that actually do help people get out of those situations. Another recent example is the changes to just the permanent residency program. So have you guys heard of the point system? So basically the point system is how a lot of people, is how my parents came in here years ago, how a lot of people get in on a permanent basis, is you basically go and you fill out this, you go apply somewhere to a Canadian embassy and you fill out this thing basically saying if you have a certain level of education, you get a certain number of points. You get a PhD, you get more points. If you speak English or French, you get points. If you have a lot of money, you get a lot of points. You know, that's how the system works. So they've actually made it so that only they've classified the different jobs. So now there's 38 jobs where if you fall into one of those professions, you got a shot at getting in. If you fall anywhere else outside of those professions, you basically have a 12 to 20 year wait to get in. It's basically a ban. And how they've done that is that they've given the Minister of Immigration, our good friend Jason Kenney, the decision-making power, the ability to basically decide who he wants to let in and who he doesn't. So before, people would apply, and you know, you apply and they'd eventually have to look at your application. Now you can apply and they don't have to look at your application. They can decide who they want to look at, they can decide based on what country you're coming from. The minister has this discretion. And this was brought in, it was snuck into a budget bill called C-50 last year, where the Conservatives basically tried to sneak it in, hopefully, and hope that no one said anything. And there were a lot of people that spoke out. No One's Legal and a lot of other groups organized rallies, organized press conferences around it to try to get the word out, but with the folks we have in government right now, they still passed it. Another major change that's been getting a lot of play in the news lately is the changes to the refugee system. So what they're doing now is that the refugee system, and you know, I hate kind of speaking in defense of the refugee system because it's already so bad. Right now, over the majority of people fail their claims. So about 60% of people fail their claims. And what they're doing now is that they're going to make it a two-tiered system. So what they're going to do is establish a list of safe countries and unsafe countries. And if you come from a safe country, then you don't get an appeal. You don't get a hearing. It's an expedited process where they will basically assume that since you come from a so-called safe country, that there's no, that you can't be a refugee and they'll probably kick you out anyways. So what makes a safe country? Again, they haven't said who's going to be on the list, but it's up to the minister to decide. And traditionally, if you look at which countries Canada has considered safe, it's been countries that they have free trade agreements with, countries they have economic agreements with. This is a really crazy example, actually. Back in 2003 in Montreal, there was a group of Algerian, non-status Algerians, that were fighting for status because there was a civil war going on in Algeria. There was a moratorium on deportations to Algeria. So there's about 1,000 people in Quebec who were kind of in limbo. They couldn't be deported because it was too dangerous, but they didn't have status. Canada signed a free trade agreement with Algeria, and basically 2 days later, they said, you know what, Algeria is safe now. We're going to lift the moratorium, and we're going to send you all back. And there's tons of those examples where basically Canada says, well, you're our economic partner, friend, whatever it is, so they don't want to make them look bad by saying, actually, you're really dangerous, and we're going to accept refugees from your country. So now they're institutionalizing that, and they're actually going to have a list of safe countries and unsafe countries. What they're also going to do, I just mentioned, is abolish hearings. So just this past few weeks ago, it was the 25th anniversary of Refugee Rights Day, which is based on the 1984 Singh decision, they call it, in the Supreme Court, which basically said that, yes, people who are here filing for refugee claims or filing for immigration status do have charter rights. It was a huge decision. Basically said that people applying this have basic charter rights the same as anyone else, which also meant that they had to have hearings. What this change is going to do is abolish that. It's going to set back the legislation 25 years back to the Supreme Court, because they're going to say that if you're from a safe country, you don't get a hearing in front of a what was before a semi-arbitrary judge, because they're political appointees, but you still had a hearing. Now you have 8 days to tell your story to a civil servant, and then they make a decision. And of course, civil servants work for the conservative government. You can imagine what kind of political leanings they're going to have. So, I mean, that's just some of the changes. There's a lot more little ones and kind of details here and there. But just to give you an idea of where they're going, and I think it sounds like a lot of different things, but when you look at it, if you step back and look at it all together, what you really see is what the system is. It's not a system of just, you know, helping people out or allowing people to come to Canada. It's really a system of control. Basically, by making it harder for people to come in through the point system or on any permanent basis, by making it harder for people to come in through the refugee system, and basically, and increasing the numbers of temp work. In 2008 was actually the first time that there was more people that entered the workforce on a temp basis than there was permanent residents coming into the country. And that's the kind of shift that's happening. And what it really results in is a system that makes people permanently temporary. Makes it harder for people to come in. So you look at the overall, and there's, you know, Canadian policies around the world pushing people out of their homes and displacing people and kicking them off their land and funneling them into the system where you can only get in on a temporary basis, where you have no rights, where, you know, you work for minimum wage or less, and you're tied to your employer. What it really ensures is this huge pool of cheap, exploitable labor where people have no rights. I think, you know, on the eve of International Workers' Day, it's so important to see how this system works, because, again, it's challenging that myth of Canada as this multicultural great place. What it really is actually forcing people into the situation where they have no rights. And especially the changes in the temp work program with this rule where they kick you out after 4 years, what it's going to result in is more and more people living here without any status at all. There's some estimates that range up to, you know, that there's up to 500,000 people in the country living without any status, completely undocumented, up to 200,000 just in Toronto. So what's the reality for these folks? I was talking to someone yesterday, actually, who had no status, and they were looking for a job, and they basically were looking for something, you know, cash under the table, because that's really the only thing you can do without being too worried about, you know, getting found out or reported to immigration by your boss. And the job was to work 10-hour shifts at a meatpacking plant. You know what the wage was that they offered? $3.50 an hour. Right? So, and this person was considering it because they really didn't have any other options. So when you see how the system works, that's really what the result is.
You are listening to Migrant Matters Radio on CFRU 93.3 FM. This is a recording of last year's May Day dinner and panel discussion in April 2010. The current speaker is Mohan Mishra, an organizer with No One Is Illegal in Toronto.
I think it's also important to look at what the Conservative government strategy is when they're selling these changes. Because, y'all, have you guys heard of Jason Kenney, the Minister of Immigration?
Yeah.
A great guy, yeah?
Great guy.
Yeah. So, what they've been, now, I mean, he's, you know, there's a lot of things I could say about him, but he's smart. And what they've been doing is basically running around well, he's been running around to basically every kind of immigrant or so-called ethnic community event that he can find and saying that, you know, I'm your friend, trust me, we'll help you out. Actually, just last weekend, on the celebration of Refugee Rights Day, he was speaking at an event that was put on by a human rights group. And myself and another member of No One's Legal went down there to challenge this idea, to hand out, and we basically handed out flyers talking about his so-called human, his what we called his accomplishments in human rights. And just listing some of the examples in the last year, and it was crazy. And part of the reason we did this is because the day before, one of our members, actually, who was deported about 4 months ago to Pakistan, sent us an email. And originally, they had failed a refugee claim and And the claim was based on that her dad was very sick. He was on dialysis. You know, and he was in pretty dire condition here, and that if they were deported, there's no way that he was going to survive. Immigration Canada, in all their wisdom, said, you'll be fine. And they sent him back anyways. So on Friday, we got an email from this friend of ours basically saying that, as they thought, her dad's health went downhill, and he ended up passing away just a month ago because the healthcare that he needed wasn't available, as they've said repeatedly over and over again. Meanwhile, you have Kenny running around to all these various events trying to sell these changes by basically dividing the community. And how he's doing that is saying that what we're going to do is change the system to streamline it so that we'll get rid of the quote-unquote bogus refugee claimants and make it the process faster for everyone else. In reality, like I said, what he's doing is basically making it harder for anyone that's poor or a person of color or from a country that Canada doesn't like, making it harder for them to come in, or if they do, funneling them into these temp work jobs. So I think it's important to basically look at how do we challenge this. You know, we've got this conservative government that's passing all these policies. What are the ways we can challenge it? We know that we're not going to go up and say, well, conservative government, this is messed up. You know, it's not very nice. You're really screwing people over. Can you change your policies? So what do we do? And I think if we look back at a lot of the work that's happened in the past that's been effective, we can start to get some ideas. So, for example, when there was a number of workplace raids happening last year, which a lot of folks here, I think, know about as well, let me go back a little further. Back in 2006, 2007, what we're seeing in Toronto was when the Conservative government first came in, straight up ID checks in the West End of Toronto, around subway stations, malls. Immigration officers were going up to people and saying, hey, you look like an immigrant, let me see your papers. And we knew this was happening because we were hearing about it from community members, but it wasn't getting in the news. And they were doing it because they thought that no one would speak up. So what we did was, within a few days, organize an emergency rally in that neighborhood where these checks were happening. Had 400 people come out in 2 days, got media attention, exposed what they were doing, and after that, we saw the raids actually stop. A year later, a Freedom of Information Act request we did actually showed that after that attention on what they were doing, the number of deportations actually went down. A lot of it is really just challenging and exposing what's happening. Deportations have increased by 50% in the last decade. Not a lot of people know that. If you look at the number of deportations overall, there's about 75 on average every day out of Toronto. Not a lot of people know that. So it's really exposing and challenging what's going on. One of our main campaigns is something called Sanctuary City. And this comes out of an idea that, again, while we're challenging the policies of the government and trying to force them to change, we're not going to have status for all overnight. They're not going to just, again, say, okay, you guys were right, we'll give everyone status. So how do we create that from the ground up? And that's through work that we've been doing that we call, as a campaign, Sanctuary City. And a lot of this came out of the daily experiences of people without status, where they were basically getting caught and turned over to immigration for doing things like trying to enroll their kids in school or going to the doctors or going to a food bank or whatever it is, accessing basic daily services that a lot of us take for granted, they were coming up against these borders, where borders aren't just at the airport or, you know, when you're crossing into the States, that they're, for people without status, they're actually in people's everyday lives. There was one case of a woman who was basically assaulted and raped and attacked, and she went to the police to try to get help to turn this person in, and the police said, wait a minute, you look like an immigrant, what's your status? And they turned her over to immigration enforcement, who, in this crazy twist of fate, actually scheduled her deportation on the same day she was to testify against her attacker. Through mobilization, through community pressure, we're able to actually stop her deportation, and actually, you know, she was able to testify against this person. She's now living here with permanent status. But it took a huge fight. It took this huge fight. So what Sanctuary City means is that we now are working in whatever spaces that people come across these borders in their daily lives to make sure that status doesn't even matter. For example, through years of work, we were able to force the Toronto District School Board, which is the largest in the country, about 550 schools or so, to pass an Access Without Fear policy where they said, we're not going to ask for status, and if we do find out, we're not going to talk to immigration. And further, if immigration comes to the doors of any schools, we're not going to let them in, which means that all these 550 schools in Toronto, where they weren't before, are now open to people to be able to register their kids in school without having to fear that they're going to be detained or deported. We're doing the same work in women's shelters across the city now, which came out of experiences, again, of people that we're working with, of immigration enforcement goons going into shelters in the middle of the night sometimes and going after women who are staying in these shelters who are already victims of abuse and victimizing them even further. And there's over 120 shelters across the country now signed on to this campaign, basically saying that they're not going to let immigration in. So the way that we see this work is that while the government's not going to grant status to everyone tomorrow, we're going to build it from the ground up. We're going to make sure that eventually the city, and, you know, coming out of Toronto, other cities from that, will be a place where status no longer matters, where it's irrelevant because nobody's going to ask, and make sure that the community, you know, is making our own decisions about, you know, about what's happening in our community and who's there. So, talking about Sanctuary City and talking about these demonstrations challenging the government, also here, of course, to talk about May Day and what that means and why it's so important for folks to come out. And the original kind of where May Day started for No One's Legal in Toronto was that in 2005, a number of groups of non-status people organizing in Montreal said, we've been organizing for years and the government's not listening to us. What we're going to do is actually march from Montreal to Ottawa. It's over 200 kilometers or something, took about 7 or 8 days, and say, we're going to march right to Parliament and make sure that they hear us. That they're not going to ignore thousands of migrants on the doorsteps of Parliament, making lots of noise, and actually march from Montreal to Ottawa. And out of that march spurred tons of organizing around migrant justice across the country, actually, because to see that happen was so inspiring. For the previous 4 years, kind of coming out of that, and also inspired by the amazing demonstrations on May Day in 2006 in the States, where we saw literally millions of people come out in opposition to a horribly regressive immigration policy. There was, you know, 500,000 people marching in L.A., 500,000 in Toronto, 30,000 people in Milwaukee. Like, it's just, you know, very unexpected. And out of that, it was really inspiring for organizers here. So since then, around May Day, we've been calling it the May Day of Action, the first Saturday in May, organizing Status for All demos in Toronto to really build on that, to build on that inspiration, to build on that history, to make May Day a day where people come out united in opposition to these horrible policies, in opposition not just based on your immigration status, but in opposition to the system of control being opposed, the system of exploitation of people with status, of people without status, of workers, of everyone, the system that's causing so much exploitation and oppression. And I mean, basically, since we started this, it's been getting bigger every year. How many folks here were there at last year's May Day demo? Yeah, a few people, solid. Hopefully everybody here is going to be getting on the bus to this year's demo.
I almost got arrested and beat up there.
So it's been getting bigger. It's been getting bigger every year, and what it really is a chance for people to come out of the shadows where people are forced to live and work in the shadows. But basically, it's been getting bigger every year, and what we did last year was actually start a demo in the downtown East Side, which is one of the poorer neighborhoods of Toronto, and actually roll right in and do a takeover of Yonge and Dundas Square in the middle of the city, as well as drop giant banners off the side of the Eaton Center, basically saying that we're not going to be pushed out, we're not going to be forced out. This is our space, this is our city, and we're going to keep growing and keep building it. And that's where May Day is at now. It's been getting bigger every year. Like I said, this year it's going to be even bigger. There's going to be a few more surprises for people at the demo. It'll be very fun, lots of very colorful, confrontational actions, music, food, performers, and a few kind of surprises along the way. So I hope you all come out. If you haven't gotten one of these flyers yet, starting at 1 o'clock downtown Toronto in St. Jamestown, which is actually the most densely populated immigrant neighborhood in the country and possibly North America. And it's going to be big and loud, and a chance for people to loudly proclaim their opposition to these policies and demand status for all. And the way we see status for all isn't just, again, immigration policy. Status for all means people have access to good jobs, to shelter, to housing, to food, to education, to all those things that everyone living and working in this country should have access to.
Cool. So thank you guys for listening.
That was the voice of Mohan Mishra, inviting you to last year's May Day demonstration in Toronto, Ontario. And you are listening to a recording of the 2010 May Day dinner and panel discussion in Guelph, Ontario. While it's probably too late for you to attend last year's May Day festivities, we hope you will join in for the upcoming events, both here in Guelph and in Toronto too. And to get you in the mood for May Day, we continue today's show with a presentation by Pragash Antanipalai, a worker with the NGO Canadian Humanitarian Appeal for Relief of Tamils, as well as a Tamil community organizer. In 2009, the Sri Lankan military escalated its war against the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, with the goal of eradicating the tigers from Sri Lanka. In the ensuing violence, at least 400,000 people were displaced, leaving 250,000 in refugee camps, and tens of thousands are said to have been killed. Pragash Antanipalai's presentation describes the Canadian Tamil community's response to the war, with special note of youth participation. We present this to you now on Migrant Matters Radio, CFRU 93.3 FM.
My name is Pragash. As I said, I'm with Canadian Heart, an organization. We're a humanitarian human rights activist organization. I'm going to actually start out with a little bit of a video, if we can play it. It's going to show the protests that happened in Toronto and actually all around the world by the town people. One of the nice things about that protest was one of our flags was actually a part of that, and they joined up in one of our occupations of University Street, University Avenue, one of the big thoroughfares in Toronto. And we'll get to see some of the actions that the town people took as our own lands and our people were slaughtered. We lost 30,000 of our brightest and the best and our family members. And these were the actions as a community we took. Here in Canada, in Toronto, Ottawa, Vancouver, we had some people out in Harper's hometown trying to cause little ruckus. But here's some pictures of it. Can you just play that?
It's like a wind in flare.
These protests in Toronto were actually continuous. They occupied the main thoroughfare for about, how many days was that? They made the occupation of like 100 days, but they also had a major occupation where they actually shut down the street for about 15, 20 days straight. There's about 30 to 40,000 people at one point. And we even shut down the highway, Gardner Expressway, if anybody heard about that. It was quite an intense moment. A lot of my friends and family were involved in it. It was actually quite exciting because at that point, they pretty much read the riot act to us, and they were about to pretty much beat everybody off. But our very militant women stepped forward and demanded that to get to the men, the cops would have to beat 14-year-old girls and 9-year-old grandmothers before they let the sons get beat. So it was one of our great victories because as a racialized community, we've been targeted a lot, as first as gang members, criminalized, and then as terrorists throughout the last decade. So the fact that we were able to stand up to the cops in that manner as a community as a whole, it shook the cops first of all. They're still kind of freaked out, I think, about G20 if the town people come out. So we'll talk about that afterwards. But I'll give you guys a little bit of background information. Now, Sri Lanka is an island just south of India. It has a population of about 25 million. It's close to about Canada size, but it's actually quite a bit smaller. The town population is about 12% of that. We're indigenous to the northern and eastern parts of the island, and we call it Tamil Eelam, the Tamil lands. And we were a British colony for the last 500 years, until about 1948, when we kicked the British out. But unfortunately, when the British left, they left with a constitution which united both parts of the islands under one constitution. Now, in the beginning, there's hopes that, you know, both groups can coexist. Unfortunately, right away, there's laws passed that started to discriminate against the town people right away, such as the Sinhala Language Act, which makes basically, to give an example for people to understand, it's like Canada tomorrow passing an act that English is the only language and that even in Quebec people would have to speak English to get government services or any services. And progressive acts, parliamentary acts were put forward that are far racist. One of the last kind of draws was in 77 when they passed an act which pretty much made it harder for Tamil students to get into universities. They did a proportional, so basically a Tamil student would have to get about 10% higher in grades to get into a spot in university. And this pretty much struck off a civil war for the last 30 years. It started out with about 24 different militant groups of youth rising up against the government. By the late 80s, one group, the Tamil Tigers, the LTTE, the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, became kind of the foremost group and kind of consumed everybody in there. Kind of the basic history. In the last 10 years, though, the global system, as I've started calling it, the global apartheid system, had basically maneuvered to support the Sri Lankan state in crushing the Tamil Tigers, because the Tamil Tigers, for their faults, they refused to negotiate on the anything that would go against the benefits of the town people in those areas. They're supportive of the indigenous population to a fault, and which of course the global apartheid system can't accept. The idea that any one group will favor policies that help the poor person or the poor farmer instead of the corporate monopolists is against what the system is for, and pretty much countries like Canada, U.S., they piled on support to the Sri Lankan government and crushed the Tamil Tigers last year. In the ensuing one-year campaign, there's about 40,000 people who died. In last May, the majority, about 30,000 civilians were killed in about 2 weeks' time in one beach. I actually have pictures of the actual assault where the final campaign where about the 30,000 died, where they actually basically crowded 300,000 people into the size of New York's Grand Central Park and bombarded it. This was unfortunately happening around the same time as Gaza, another situation where an indigenous group was being assaulted by a colonial government. And a lot more of the attention did go to Gaza at that point. Canada and all these other organizations kind of just kind of blanked it out as a way. I can show you some pictures if we can just, I'll show you the picture of the island. That's the island, just south of India. The yellow parts would constitute what Tamil Eelam is. It's the northern and eastern provinces within the Sri Lankan state, but those are the parts right there. It actually consists of a very strategic part in the Indian Ocean. It has the it has the only natural deep harbor. So countries like India, U.S. Want to control it because it controls the oil lanes from Saudi Arabia and Afghanistan and Iran into China and Japan through the Pacific. So if you can kind of see it, that's where all those oil tankers go. Much of the war has been fought over that. That's kind of the colonial history. We were colonized by the Portuguese, the Dutch, and finally the British in 1796. They unified the island at that point. There's three different kingdoms. One was a Tamil kingdom. One was a Middle kingdom that was kind of mixed. And then there's a Southern Sinhalese kingdom. I'll leave that at that. There's like more history and background. If anybody wants, I'll be more than happy to explain it afterwards. But I'm going to actually explain some of what happened during the protest, during the actual massacre. There's a lot of people have been interested in how the Tamil community organized like this. Because this is the first time the Tamil community's ever actually come out on force and kind of done anything in conflict with the Canadian government. There's about 300,000 Tamils in Canada, mostly in the Toronto area. Most of their participation usually goes no further than voting in elections. This was the first time that Tamil folks came out onto the streets and participate full scale in demonstrations, and even confronting police. Now, one of the funny things that happened last night, and I had to actually write my own biography, little bio, and I had to speak about myself in the third person. It was a little interesting experience. I felt like MJ there for a reason. But in all truth, there's something I wanted to say. I was a part of the groups of folks that were organizing the early protests. These were smaller protests until about 2009 January. I want to actually highlight that for a really important reason, because that's actually the point in which activists, students, and organizations stopped organizing for several reasons. First of all, RCMP and CSIS started coming down on us. They're looking for who it was. They're saying, you guys are terrorists, you guys are Tiger sympathizers, we're going to shut you guys down. And they started bringing out cases and laws against us. At which point, we couldn't organize. Those who did keep on organizing had to take a very specific line. At which point, Canadian Heart did some organizing around the IDPs, internally displaced peoples, and refugees. But at which point, even Canadian Heart stopped organizing. That was around early 2009, beginning of January. Like I said, one of the last big demos that was actually organized by a small group of people was the takeover of the Sri Lankan consulate. 20 of us actually got arrested. I'll give you the story of what happened. Basically, the night before, we'd found out 300 people died. Family members, friends. My cousins called me and they're like, did you hear the news? I was like, what's the news? They killed 300 people yesterday. It didn't even come on any news or anything. I was like, oh shit, what are we going to do? I don't know, let's all get together, we'll see what we can do. We got to organize something, write a letter or something. So we got together. By the time I got there, they're like, we're all going to get together tomorrow, we're going to go to Sri Lankan consulate, or we're going to try to stage a protest. This wasn't a Canadian Heart protest, this was a lot of my friends and my family members, because we knew people that were dying. Basically though, the plan was we would sit in the actual consulate and demand an answer and demand that the Sri Lankan government let food, water, and medicine be allowed into the Tamil areas, which was being blockaded, much like Gaza. You'll see this is a pattern forming. This is a pattern that even the Canadian government has used against indigenous peoples, blocking food, water, and medicine to the civilian population to break the fighters. And that was our demands. Now, we were kind of like, okay, we'll put the word out. We'll get people on the streets. I don't know, maybe we'll get a couple hundred people. So in the morning we went, 20 of us. 18 of us went upstairs into the consulate, sat down, and refused to move. There's no violence or anything. We even had cameras just to prove it. We were recording everything. We sat down, locked ourselves to the seats, and said we would refuse to move until the Sri Lankan government gave us a response as a part of the consulate, at which point they called the police, and they called us terrorists. Me and a friend were downstairs, and we got the call. The cops have been called. They're coming up, and we see the cops go up. They're going to arrest us, and they're like, so is everybody down there? Do we have, lots of people to stop the arrest? We had nobody. It was just the two of us. And I was like, oh, shit. So we started actually calling, everybody then, and they're, our friends, and we're like, go on the radio, tell people. And then, one of our friends was in the area. A Tamil seniors group, because of what had happened before, was actually down the street at Young and Bloor, holding up signs as a silent protest while we'd gone to the consulate as another protest. So what happened was
We sent somebody down, ran down. It was about 15 minutes by like bus. They came back with them, and so that was about another 40 people. And then they all started calling these radio stations in the Tamil communities, and people then started to come down. So in about 2 hours, we had 4,000 people there. So we went from about 20 punks to about like 4,000 people, seniors, and students started to come out. And the cops were like, what the hell happened? We just saw you two down here. And then like, we'd actually brought about 100 like posters, but we had nobody to hold them. So when the people came down, they started holding them. So that was pretty much, it was kind of, this is what happened. By the end of that, there was no more protests organized by any single group. No single group can actually do it anymore. But all you'd have to do is turn on a Tamil radio or a Tamil radio station. There's about two or three in Toronto. There's two Tamil TV stations. And for every day, every hour, there are people calling in and debating what to do. There's several protests such as the Human Chain where it was just like, everybody come out, we'll hold hands, we'll silently stand, we'll hold posters, we'll try to, totally ignored. Did a second time when another like 2,000 people were killed. Every weekend, the casualty figures were going up and there was getting no reportage. And there's a reason for this. But originally what the people blamed is linguistics instead of politics. We don't speak English well enough. Because these were working class people doing this. These are like my grandmother, my mom, who don't speak perfect English. At which point we actually organized communication brigades. Basically, we would go out whenever there's a camera and they would ask a question. We would jump in and explain the situation. Because we sounded Canadian, no matter what our status was. And then we found out the response was the same. They still ignored us. They actually, you know, you could speak for 10 minutes and explain the whole history, as I've just done for you folks. They would cut it out to about 20 seconds and be like, Tamil Tigers fighting Sri Lankan government, Tamils protesting. And that was pretty much it. And there's a question. Why was that? Why were we blocked as 2,000, 3,000 people were being killed a day? On Mother's Day was the biggest. As we were celebrating Mother's Day here, the final assaults on the beaches started. We actually got in the news that 3,000 to 4,000 people were slaughtered on Mother's Day. I remember actually coming down from a friend's birthday party, and I got the text message. Oh my God, 4,000 people dead. I don't know what we're going to do, but we need to do something. And people basically, text messages started flying. Everybody go downtown, meet up downtown. And then on the radios, people were discussing, what should we do? Should we bring the flag? Should we do this, do that? And the debates had begun. And that's where decisions were made. So people are like, yeah, I'm going to bring the flag. I don't care what anybody else says. And the flag I showed you is the Tamil Eelam flag. At that point, it was actually banned. They're trying to ban it as a terrorist flag, as identification of a terrorist group. That's why I'd mentioned at York, we'd actually worked very hard to get it recognized as our cultural heritage, that it was our symbol instead of the Sri Lankan state's flag, which is actually a very abhorrent for us. A part of that, and this is kind of where the difference in the community of what had happened. We have political leaders in our community, political elites that are connected to government parties, like the Liberals, mostly, a little bit of the Conservatives, and a little bit of the NDP. And they were like, don't bring the flags. Don't do that. You're scaring the you're scaring the politicians because the media spin. Because at that point, it would be like terrorist protests in downtown. Tamil Tiger flags everywhere. We were trying to explain, no, this is the Tamil Eelam flag. The LTT flag is white. It has LTT on it. And they wouldn't listen. And our political elites were like, no, you know, don't do that. And this is what I mean, that nobody can actually organize these protests anymore because it was actually the people deciding. Basically, like, you know, our political advisors, our political leaders, our community leaders were like, don't bring the flag. It's not working. Stop it, guys. So what happened? For 14 days, all the town people went to Ottawa with the flag in front of the politicians and demanded that the politician come out and speak. This was in like negative like 10 weather, and people like stayed overnight, stayed there, and basically they went on the streets and they blocked half of Ottawa. I believe the cost was $2 million for the Ottawa Police Department. So there was an impact. And the difference of what like a community mobilizing versus what organizations or certain groups can mobilize was seen right there. Because we would actually have like the cops calling us, like at Kennedy Heart, do you guys know what's going on? Are the townless going to go to the street and block it? Like, do you know? We're like, no. We're like a human rights organization. We're not on the street. They're like, okay. And we actually heard a lot of our friends got calls like that. And we're like, we don't know until like the text messages start flying. Somebody starts a text message and it starts being like spread as we were talking about like 50 text messages forwarded. I feel sorry for Mohan because he only five. He only forward five at a time at that point. I could forward like 100 and my friends with like iPhones had to do it one at a time. So, but it was done and the messages would go out and people would actually hit the streets.
You are listening to Migrant Matters Radio on CFRU 93.3 FM. Today's show is a recording of last year's May Day dinner and panel discussion in Guelph, Ontario. We continue now with the presentation by Pragash Antanipalai, a Canadian Tamil community organizer, discussing the 2009 protests by the Canadian Tamil community.
It was done, and the messages would go out, and people would actually hit the streets. And there was actually a simple message they wanted to get out that was blocked. And this is why, as a lot of folks were really disenfranchised with our leaders, because this message, as simple as it was, there's only 4 points. This is all we want recognized, and our leaders couldn't do it. Basically, that the Tamil Eelam identity, which the majority of the Canadian Tamil community identified with, constitute a distinct national, linguistic, and ethnic identity separate from the Sri Lankan state. That people existed outside of nation states, recognized or not. That, and I'm gonna put a little bit of like an asterisk beside this, as the community decided that the only legitimate representatives of this identity on a political scale were the Tamil Tigers and their leader, Velu Prabhakaran. Now, important side notice, Canadian Heart as an organization does or does not endorse this statement because we're a primarily human rights organization. We do recognize the right of groups for armed resistance as enshrined within the United Nations Human Rights Declaration and international laws and covenants. But as a group, we have often been maligned by the Sri Lankan state and supporters for the work we do as human rights activists as being LTT proxies, simply because we've always demanded that they allow food, water, medicine to the women, children, and old people in the area. And because of that, we've been called terrorists. The Sri Lankans, and the third point was that the Sri Lankan state, for the last 6 years, has committed a systematic campaign of ethnic cleansing and genocide to destroy the separate identity, and this was the reason why that the Tamil community was so huge in Toronto. Most of us had fled from this. I was actually born in the middle of a pogrom. In 1983, the year I was born in, they killed 2,000 Tamils in the capital city. They burned, butchered, and slaughtered them right in their homes. This happened in 1983. And this is when a majority of Tamils actually fled the island. And the final point was, and this was the only demand that we asked, that Canada had a clear obligation and responsibility to intervene and prevent this through either sanctions or political sanctions or whatever. The coming mass murder of thousands of Tamil civilians, family members of Canadians, status or non-status, which the Sri Lankan state was now orchestrating right in front of our eyes. We sent the information to the news agencies and it was totally ignored. At this point, a lot of the Tamil community members got disenfranchised and they wondered why. Now, I'd stated something before. It was a simple idea that Tamils had thought our problem with communicating with the wider Canadian audience was a linguistic one, not a political one. It was actually, though, as we've worked oftentimes here at Canadian Heart, there's actually a very deep system of apartheid, not just in Canada, but there's a global apartheid system. When Indigenous groups actually demand for sovereignty, their demands for their lands they already live on, they've lived on for thousands of years, such as the Palestinians in Palestine, the Nilgiris, in the Nilgiri Mountains, or FARC in Colombia. When groups are refuse that sovereignty and they take up arms in defense, they're often labeled as terrorists. That's delegitimized that. The right to self-defense. Now, this is the new paradigm that we live in where you can't even defend yourself when somebody's come. Imagine this. Somebody comes into your home, robs everything from you, and they're killing your like family, raping your wives, daughters, and then you have no right to defend yourselves with whatever means you have. The Sikh brother, I'm sure, understands this, and Khalistan and what happened. And then they're called terrorists for defending themselves. And Canada has been a huge proponent of this. Even though the Tamil community has tried very hard to actually educate it, where it's always the indigenous group that's vilified and called terrorists, while the state, it can be as the most fascist state in the world, slaughtering thousands at a time, is supported. Exactly. Shame. And that's exactly the system, and this is the first things that the Tamil community has learned in this time and period, that we do live in an apartheid system where colored immigrant people don't have the same voice. We are expected just to be the workers, to work at the coffee shop, be temporary workers, and not to express the right that human rights of people overseas, that our family members, do matter, that the human rights of people in Palestine do matter. They're no less equal than us. And that is the apartheid system that we live in, and Canada is, because of its own apartheid system, is very, very much a part of that. The war on terror, all these things, is very deeply linked, and as I've started to say to many of my friends, it's a global system of apartheid. And this is where Canadian Heart, our mission is to try to actually create solidarity between indigenous groups, workers, and workers in class struggles, to actually work towards that. And if anybody's interested in that aspect as well, we're more than happy to work with anybody working towards the rights of indigenous peoples and the human rights of peoples everywhere.
To grow nuts, slaving over the hot stove, cooking up cold cuts. Yeah, so much for trying to keep out of trouble. Cause I'm bored. Let's now get the beat out. Let's run, kid. Yeah, see the meats grinding and putting pits at. I'm not just a silly pine for the bits at. That's where you never seen the likes in your life. Plus, I owe you a free bounce. I'm not to never. So get your mitts right for your dead night. Ain't like you gotta learn what the shit cost. I sold me so far that I got ripped off. So if goes dark nights is lost, so trust me. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry. I don't sing green, but I frighten Nambi, Pambi, Bambi. Yes, fear steps quite the little lads to think the bright. You can try it if you fancy so. See, I got the saffron, I got the arc and the confidence. I got the catch pajamas and you're not getting on it. Cause I don't know what it is, but I got it. I got the saffron, I got the arc and the confidence. I got the cat's pajamas and you're not getting on it. Cause I don't know what it is, but I got it. You don't think that I bullied the beef when I put the North Face on. Always warm with the hoodie underneath. So come and cut your teeth, these are test and sands. Blood, sweat, and tears off of the next electrical appliance. And all that, I can tell that your fingers all lack. The grind hustle is the Jack Russell's. I'm the torch, yeah, but time into his quarters for a short nap. Hold the roll in a poor mag. Yeah, read between the lines, make like a beak at book rim, and you'll see in time. Really, I'm being chased by CGI life size with the beatiest thighs. So, study, but I think the are after me. So it's less of a more salt and battery. See me walk casually through town on me black, but even Peter Andre Blasting in the show of solidarity. Yeah, kiddie, see, I got the saffron, I got the arc and the confidence. I got the cat's pajamas, and you're not getting on it. Cause I don't know what it is, but I got it. I got the saffron, I got the arc and the confidence. I got the cat's pajamas and you're not getting on it. Cause I don't know what it is, but I got it. See, I flow like a dead body, sting like no cauliflower ears. I define norms like blind forms, they got no idea. How the f*** would do it, I was a coping fluid. Thousands of units get found on me drunk and stupid. Surrounded by tons of students, I learned the whole of balloon and sewers. This life really looks a bit mad. Took a bit on, said he owns 26 guys. A mismatch, a mismatch, kid is the live fast. Picking fatties with big racks to leak the black. Johnny Vegas in drag. Well, you'd imagine him to look like a sump. That's pretty bin black. Got a bin bag slung over me shoulder. For every sin that I